Welcome to Writers' Voices. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson, guest host, sitting in for Monica Hadley and her mother, Carolyn. And I'm thrilled to inform you that today we have as our guest Jacqueline Briggs Martin, a children's writer from Mount Vernon who's done some excellent work. Her picture book, Snowflake Bentley, was highly acclaimed. It received the Caldecott Award. Caldecott, of course, is for pictures, but Jacqueline created the text that supported some wonderful art. And I believe that book also won some other awards, but we'll have Jacqueline tell us about that in a little while. But first, welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you, Cheryl. It's nice to be here.
And we're here today to talk about Jackie's latest book. And would you tell us the title and a little bit about that?
The book is called The Chiru of High Tibet. And it's a nonfiction story about an endangered animal called the chiru, which is looks a little bit like an antelope. It's about the size of a sheep, and it lives only in Tibet, and has, because it lives in such a cold place, has very fine fleece, so fine that a strand of chiru hair is 1/7 the thickness of human hair.
This was a fascinating picture book. I was really thrilled to be able to read this, and the pictures are incredible. But I wondered what led you to this project.
I was on the road, actually. I was in my car driving to a school visit in 2003, and I was listening to the radio. And I heard a man named Rick Ridgway talking about a trip that he and three of his mountain climbing friends had made, walking 250 miles across the northern plains of Tibet, following a herd of female chiru to find where they go to give birth. Because their fleece is so fine, when it's woven into a shawl, the shawl is warm and light. And these shawls were selling for thousands of dollars in Paris, New York, and London. So the chiru were being slaughtered to get the wool for these shawls. And they wanted to make a preserve where the chiru would be safe, but they didn't know where they go to give birth. They didn't know where to ask the Chinese government to make the preserve. And the only way to find out was to follow them. So that's what they did. They followed them on foot, pulling wagons, kind of like rickshaws, with their food, their water, and their tents, to find this birthing site and ask the Chinese government to make it into a preserve. When I heard this story, when I heard Rick Ridgway talking about this, I was in my car, I thought, this is such a wonderful story. I have to write about it for kids. And so if I hadn't been going to that school, if I hadn't been in my car, I might not have had the radio on, and I might never have known about it, never have known to write about it.
That's an incredible story. That just the story itself is so amazing, but then that you made the connection that you could produce something for children from that just little radio story that you heard is kind of cool. I see some correlations between this book and Snowflake Bentley. They're both, because you don't always write nonfiction, but these two picture books are both nonfiction.
Yes, they
right?
are.
Yes. But you've also done a lot of fiction picture books. And have you done other nonfiction projects as well?
I did a book that came out in 2001 called The Lamp, the Ice, and the Boat Called Fish. And it's a story of the Canadian Arctic Expedition of 1913. A man named Vilmer Stephenson wanted to take an expedition up into the Arctic Sea. He thought he would discover new land and become famous, and that was his goal, was to become famous. So he kind of overlooked things like the recipe for the pemmican that they ate and the kind of boat that they had. His boat wasn't really strong enough to go through Arctic ice. And they got up there and they encountered Arctic ice, and the boat became trapped in the ice, and Stephenson just abandoned the party. He took the best hunters, his secretary, and the best dogs, and said he was going off to hunt caribou. He wired the government in Ottawa and said the boat was trapped in the ice, but he was sure that everyone would be okay. And he left to find new land. Then the boat was under the care of the captain, Captain Bartlett, but they would not have survived without an Inupiaq couple, Kiruk was the wife and Kuruluk was the husband. And they had two children with them, two daughters, 8-year-old and a 1-year-old.
And what they saw the boat trapped in the ice? Is that what?
Well, they were along to sew furs, to sew and to hunt. Kiruk was the sower and Kuruluk was the hunter, and they were going to provide meat. He was going to provide meat for this expedition, and she was going to sew warm fur clothes. So they had been picked up in Barrow, Alaska. Stephenson had hired them to come on the trip.
Well, that was a lucky break for the crew that was left behind.
And they brought their two daughters. And I happened on this story. I was reading around. And when I saw that these two girls had this great adventure, I thought, oh, this would be a wonderful story for kids. So that also is a nonfiction story.
Okay, so you come across incredible stories, and then you decide, you know, your creative juices get flowing, and you decide you want to pursue a project for children. How do you go about research? You know, with your latest book, it looks like you contacted the actual people who were on this expedition.
I did. I'll talk about that one first, and then if other things come up, I'll certainly talk about my other nonfiction books, too. After I heard Rick Ridgway on the radio, I knew that I wanted to do some research on this, and he was on the radio because he had written a book called The Big Open about this walk across 250 miles of Tibet. So I bought that book, and I read it, and he talked a lot about the Chiru and about a biologist named George B. Schaller, who really is the one who had done the most research on the Chiru. He had been to Tibet many times researching the wildlife in Tibet. And he's the one who figured out that the Chiru were being killed to get the fleece to weave into these shawls. Up until that time, there was a kind of untruth that everybody believed that these tufts of wool were gathered off bushes by the children of nomads. Well, it turns out that actually in Tibet, there aren't any bushes that are tall enough to snag any tufts of wool. It's so dry and so cold, the vegetation is all about 8 inches tall. So there really wouldn't be any tufts of wool to be gathered, and there aren't any Tibetan goats to give that wool. So that was a total falsehood. And Schaller found a lot of dead Chiru, and he didn't know why they were being killed. And then he came into contact with somebody who was looking at the traffic in these shawls. And Schaller figured out that the Chiru were the source of wool for these Shatush shawls. And that's when he went to the Chinese government and said, ask them to make a preserve.
What country was he from?
He's from the United States. He's a biologist. Well, actually, he grew up in Germany, Cheryl, and he attended the University of Alaska and must have emigrated at some point in his career to the United States, and he now works at the Bronx Zoo and has for many years.
You contacted him.
I did. I read his books. He's written a number of books on the wildlife of Tibet. I read his books. I read Rick Ridgway's book, and I read three of the four people who went on this Ridgway expedition had written books. Conrad Anker is the person who discovered Mallory's body on Mount Everest, and he wrote a book about that. So I read his book. Galen Rowell, who went along as a photographer, was a wonderful nature photographer, and he wrote many books, and I read a couple of his books. I thought I wanted to get to know these men before I wrote about them, and I thought one way to do that would be to read some of their writing. The fourth person was Jimmy Chin, and he, at that time, had not written any books. I'm not sure if he has now.
And were these men all from different countries, or did they come together because of this project?
They came together because of this project. They're all from the United States. And had known each other, except for Jimmy Chin. I'm not sure that he knew them. He's younger. He's actually the same age as my son, and he went to the same college that my son did.
So he must have felt a real connection.
Yes.
Now, was this the kind of reading you normally do? Like, do you read a lot of nature?
I do read nature writing. I had not read, I might not have read Conrad Anker's book about finding Mallory's body if I hadn't wanted to know Conrad Anker, but it certainly wasn't new ground for me. I often read nature writing and enjoy it.
Okay, so you hit upon, I have to ask this question, did you ever touch one of these shawls? Did you ever see one of the shawls they made out of these chiru?
No, I haven't. I want to, but it's illegal to buy or sell them. So I would have to...
Are they in museums or anything like that?
George Schaller probably has one, you know, salted away to use as an example. Uh-huh. But I think they're incredibly soft. You're supposed to be able to pull an entire shawl through a wedding ring. They're that soft and that light. And before people knew that chiru were being killed, they would sell. People who could afford them would buy two or three because they're so warm and so comfortable. But they sell for $10,000. So children's book writers don't have that many of them.
So you received a grant because you did some travel for this book.
As I was doing research for the story, I thought I really need to see these animals in order to write this story. And I thought that maybe they would be in a zoo somewhere, like maybe the San Diego Zoo, because I've heard it has a lot of animals. So I wrote to George Schaller and said, where can I go to see these animals? And I had kind of geared myself up to go out to the San Diego Zoo. And he wrote me back and said, they only survive in Tibet. They have not survived in zoos.
Which is why he was so passionate about finding the birthing grounds and making it a preserve.
That's right. If they couldn't live in Tibet, that would be the end of them because we couldn't save a population anywhere. And then I thought, well, how am I going to get to Tibet? Well, lucky for me, my college, Wellesley College, gives travel grants, awards travel grants to alumni who have projects, which I think is just wonderful to assume that we don't stop wanting to travel and wanting to learn when we graduate. So I wrote up my project and applied for a grant, and I was awarded a travel grant, which allowed me to go to Tibet and to have a guide who could take me up to this very remote area. He had never even been there before.
No, wait, you didn't go to the actual birthing ground.
I didn't go to the birthing area.
That's pretty secret.
Yeah.
It's not like a tourist destination.
No, I couldn't go there. But I did go to where the chiru live during the time of the year when they are not giving birth. And I did see the males. The females had already left for the birthing ground, but I did see a lot of male chiru.
What was that experience like for you?
I had to pinch myself every morning, Cheryl. It was so incredible to be so far from home in such a new and different place for me. I was thrilled to be there.
This is quite an adventure for a children's book writer who's used to sitting at your desk at home producing
exactly.
Your books.
Yeah. I was also homesick. You know, I had two conflicting feelings just about every day. One was, I am so lucky to be here. And the other was, oh, I miss my family so much.
Were you alone, except for your guides?
We had a guide, a driver, and a cook. And there was one other person on the trip, a Swiss park director, who was very interested in the chiru. So there were five of us.
So it was all people doing some sort of projects, writing, or just investigating?
He was doing research. He kept track of every animal, every bird that he saw, and he plotted it on his Tibet map. So I think he was doing some kind of research into populations of animals.
So it was the two of you.
It was the two of us.
With the cook.
The cook, the guide, and the driver.
So your husband wasn't coming
He did
along.
Not go. He did not go. No.
What an interesting experience for you.
It was. It was very interesting. And the altitude is 15,000 feet above sea level. So for several days, I was adjusting to the altitude.
So like headachy and...
Mm-hmm. And no energy, like just carrying my binoculars around my neck. I felt like I had a millstone.
Were you camping in tents?
We flew to Beijing, and then the next day we flew to Lhasa, and we spent a day in Lhasa, and then we drove. The first night we were in a hotel that was moderately Western, still in heavy tourist area, lots of monasteries. The next night we were in a Tibetan motel that we could see Mount Everest from that motel. That was the staging area. Oh, in the 20s for mountain climbers, they stayed in this very motel. After that, we tented. So we tented another night or two, and then we got ready to go to the area where the Chiru live, called the Chung Tung Reserve. And our guide and driver had never been there before. They had to hire a nomad on a motorcycle to lead us to this preserve.
Well, you're such a dedicated author, and I think that's one of the things that informs your books, is you take it very seriously. You're not just tossing things off. So let's first remind listeners who might have just tuned in. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices. I'm guest host today for Monica Hadley, who's away. And with me is Jacqueline Briggs Martin. She has produced a beautiful picture book for children called The Chiru of High Tibet. And we're discussing how she got the idea for this book and then made a trip to Tibet. So at what point did you make this trip? Had you had already, of course, read the books of the people who went on this expedition.
I had read the books. I had done the research. I had written back and forth with George Schaller. I had met Rick Ridgway. And I had a draft of the story. Not the final draft, but I had a draft of the story.
So did you feel like you could have written this book? Let's say you didn't find a way to get there. Do you think you still would have gone ahead?
I think I would have gone ahead, but I think it would be a different book. I think it would sound different and it would look different. Because I actually went to the place where the Chiru live, I had a sense of the openness, and I don't want to exactly use the word desolate because it's too beautiful to be desolate, but it's maybe like parts of our American West in that there are very few signs of human life, human habitation, human activity there. It's open and natural without the imprint of humans.
Okay, well, let's go back to the experience. So you're in the tents. How long were you staying in tents and observing?
We went to three different places in the Chung Tung Reserve, and we tented for 12 days.
12 days?
Yes.
So you're there with the rest of the party all guys?
Or was yes. Yes, the rest of the party was guys. The cook, the driver, and the guide, and the park ranger. There were five of us total. I had my own little tent, but the guide would never let me put it up, although I was perfectly capable of doing that. He would say, "No, madam, I will do your tent." The park ranger always did his tent. And I think the cook, the driver, and the guide, although they had tents, I think they slept in the car.
Huh.
I don't know why, but they did.
Did that make you nervous, that they felt like for some reason they should sleep in the car? Did you think, maybe I shouldn't be out in the tent?
Maybe I should sleep in the car, too.
If there were wild animals or something that scared them off?
No, you know, that didn't actually make me, I didn't even think about that.
What was the sky like? Would you look up and see incredible stars because there wasn't any, you know, artificial light at night?
You know what's funny? I was so tired at night, and I have regretted this. This is probably my one big regret. I would go to bed, and I don't think, I hate even to tell you this, but I don't think I looked at the sky once at night. Isn't that, I was just so focused on getting through the day,
I guess. What were the days like? What were you doing during the day?
I would get up, the cook would make us breakfast, and then I would go out for a walk. And in my early days there, I was a very slow walker. And
that's because you were still getting used to less oxygen.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's higher concentration oxygen.
I think it's less. I think you were right the first time that it's thinner. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Oftentimes just sit down and just look around and think how amazing it was that I was there. I read. I had brought Taylor Branch's first book about Martin Luther King. Of course, the title escapes me right now, but I had this. It's about a 10-pound book. It was a wonderful book to take to Tibet because it was so set in the United States. So it was a little way when I would get homesick, I'd read a little Taylor Branch and go back to the United States in the 60s. And that was kind of a nice counterpoint to being there. So I'd walk, I'd read, I'd do some more walking, take some pictures. The guide and I would often go off on little jaunts. The Swiss park director would be gone all day. He had his own agenda and he would leave in the morning and not come back. So there was really nothing for the guide to guide him with. And I was the guide's only project. So we would often go off looking for a yak or walk up into the mountains or something like that.
And did you see Chiru right away?
We saw Chiru maybe our second day once we got up to the Chung Tung. We didn't see them when we were just driving across Tibet. But once we got into the Chung Tung, we began to see them.
What was the food like that you were eating in camp?
They had brought boxes of Chinese vegetables and eggs and rice.
Actual
and
fresh
Chinese
vegetables?
Actual, like, bok choy and things like that.
Oh, that sounds like it would be good.
It was. For the most part, it was good. Although, I don't think the cook was the most dedicated cook in the world. I think he may have had other employment before he got this trip. Because we threw away a lot of bok choy and stuff that I kind of think he just didn't want to chop up.
Oh, that's my husband's favorite vegetable is bok choy.
It was wonderful. And I had a fried egg for breakfast every morning. They brought a lot of eggs. So was always our breakfast.
Are they meat eaters or vegetarians?
Well, we couldn't bring very much fresh meat. So the kind of meat we had was a lot of sausage, you know, smoked dried meat.
Like beef jerky in
the
West.
Yeah, kind of like beef jerky. Huh. Yeah.
Okay, so you walked around. Did you do any writing while you were there?
I kept a journal. Every day I wrote in my journal. I took a lot of pictures. And it's interesting. I also wrote to my husband every day because I just wanted that sense of connection that you always have when you write a letter.
He wouldn't actually
mail
the letters.
No, I didn't mail them. They're still in the back of my journal. Once I got home, I didn't even need to show them to him. It was for me that I did it, I think. You know, when you're writing to someone, they're with you in the room, and that's what I needed. So I wrote to my parents, and I wrote to my kids, and
did you send your parents and your kids the letters? So
no,
you still have all those letters.
I still have all
those
letters.
And that was saying different things than what you were putting in your actual journal entries. That's so interesting. This whole story is just like fascinating to me. So were there some high points that you would like to share of the trip? The first time you saw the Chiru?
That was certainly exciting. We had climbed up to the top of the hill, and it was one of my early days. So just getting up there was quite something, and we didn't know if we'd see them. But then the guide said, look, over there. And there they were. And then there was a morning. It snowed almost every night. I slept with my clothes on because even though I had a down-filled sleeping bag, it was cold. We woke up, and there was still a lot of snow on the ground. And we were going to go to a new campsite. And as we were driving, we looked down into this valley. And there were probably 100 male Chiru with their black horns and their black legs just standing down in this valley. And against the snow, they were so beautiful.
Did you get that image in your book? There's a phrase where you say where the black antlers look like
a moving forest of trees. Branches.
Is that what you thought when you saw them?
It kind of does look like a lot of branches. And another wonderful time for me, I was out with Jinpa, the guide. We were driving around, just looking around the area. And we saw a Chiru horn that had, I don't know, been knocked off in a fight. Or I'm not sure how it got there. But in any case, there it was. And we stopped the truck. And Jinpa got out, and he said, even though this is probably not legal to do, it's kind of like us picking up bird feathers by the side of the road from a dead hawk. We shouldn't do it, but in any case, Jimpa did, and he probably won't get in trouble from this far away. Picked up the horn and said, "I'm going to keep this horn. If my baby gets sick, I'll put a little scraping in boiling water, and my baby will be better." He had a one-month-old baby that had just been born before he left. And I thought, what a quaint custom. And then I got back home and I began to read about the minerals in these horns. And it turns out that they do have healing minerals in them. So that's a case where folk wisdom turns out to be really wisdom. But it was so nice to see that for myself, that the Chiru are important to the Tibetans.
And you did convey that through the text of your picture book. I always wonder when you hear about customs like that, who was the first person that thought, I think I'll shave some of this horn into some water and make a paste to feed to my baby? Or, you know, like eating an artichoke. I always think, who ever thought there was any edible part to this vegetable?
You do wonder how they happened on that and how many other things they might have shaved or tried to eat on the way to getting to the
ones. To finding something that actually worked.
Useful. The other thing that I was really glad to see for myself is how important the Chiru are generally to Tibetans. I went into a few homes, and oftentimes I would see a picture of Chiru, or I would see a painted Chiru skull that was very elaborately decorated, and it made me think that they are kind of a totemic animal for Tibetans. Mm.
Well, they sound intriguing because they're so small, you know.
They're not very big. They have a very good sense of hearing. They can hear a sound from a fifth of a mile away, and they're very shy.
Do they have natural predators other than man?
Yes, they do. Like sheep. I'm trying to think. There are wolves there. We saw a wolf. And if there were a weakened Chiru or a young Chiru that might be vulnerable, there are also occasional, we did not see any, but there are occasional leopards, snow leopards there. So,
did you do training before you left for this trip? Like, are you used to doing a lot of hiking and camping?
Well, I live in Mount Vernon, as you said early on, and there is a hill in Mount Vernon. So the only training I did was to walk up one side of the hill, down the hill, back up. I'd go up and down the hill, for a half hour every day for a month before I left. But nothing could have prepared me for the altitude. I wasn't in bad shape hiking-wise, but the altitude change was a huge change. And when I got back home, usually walking up the hill in Mount Vernon, it's a fairly steep hill. It's not long, but it's fairly steep. I'm a little bit short of breath when I get to the top, but after being in Tibet for 3.5 weeks, I could walk up that hill and carry on a conversation for the entire time because my lungs were so accustomed to not having very much oxygen, I think.
Has that lasted?
Oh, no. No, that's too bad.
That's gone. Like, that's sort of nice. So when you came back, did you have any re-entry problems? Or was it just like you had missed your family and you're really thrilled to get back home? Or did it feel like overstimulating? I know you're from a small town.
I didn't have that kind of re-entry problem. But I did wish that it weren't so hard to get to Tibet. I have often wished I could just go back.
Do you think you will go back someday?
I don't know. I would like to. I would like to know what happened to my guide. He was a wonderful person. And for a while, I had his email address and we could make contact. But tourism in Tibet is not a sure thing. Every now and then the borders are closed and... So I don't know, even if he still has that job, I don't know what he's doing, and I would like to know.
Do you have a sequel of some sort? Yeah, like, what's your next project, do you think?
Well, it's not set in Tibet. My next project is actually a fiction story, a made-up story, inspired by four ducks on the farm where my husband and I get vegetables every summer.
So you go to you drive to a farm?
We have a share in a community supported agriculture. So we drive out once a week and get our share of vegetables. And our farmer, Laura Kraus, had four Indian racer ducks last summer.
Is that an exotic?
It's some kind of breed. I don't know if it's exotic, Cheryl, but it's a very curious breed of duck. And I wish I could show you, because they have very long necks. And I never thought ducks had chins, but they must, because Indian racer ducks don't. And they look really funny with these long necks and skinny beaks. And the other thing that makes them very funny is they all walk in the same direction at the same time. And if one turns, they all turn. So they're not just randomly moving around. They seem to move in a cluster, like they share one intelligence amongst them, and it directs them all to go in the same way.
I love your mind is so agile and so curious and so observant. It's just always delightful to chat with you. But let me remind our listeners, this is Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices. I'm guest host today for Monica Hadley. And my guest author is Jacqueline Briggs Martin, a children's picture book writer from Mount Vernon. And she has been talking about the Chiru of High Tibet. Who is your publisher on this book?
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
And it came out in 2010. Mm-hmm. And it's already received some awards.
Well, it's received some recognition. It was named to the Smithsonian Magazine's list of best books for 2010. And Kirkus Reviews also put it on their list of best books for 2010. And the Parents' Choice Foundation awarded it a silver medal, or put it on their silver medal list for books that are good for kids.
That's wonderful. And well-deserved. It's a beautiful book, and the art on it is incredible. I also meant to remind listeners, this is 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio. And let me ask a little about your illustrator for this book. Did you provide her with some of the photographs that you took?
I did. I sent her an album of photographs from my trip and tried to identify what was in the photographs. And when I was there, I remember taking certain pictures because I wanted her to see the colors of the glaciers and of the hillsides, and also pictures of the vegetation.
Did you feel like the photographs were able to capture? Because it seems like color is difficult sometimes.
I think that it captured some of it, and I think maybe the sense of openness as well. I don't know. She had other resources that she used, so I know that my photographs weren't the only thing that she used, but I was glad that I could send her some.
Do you see some connection between the photographs and some of the illustrations?
Every now and then I see some that make me think. Just the sense of openness and what I was talking about before, that really there's so little sign of humans there. And I think she did a wonderful job, however she did it, from my photographs or her own imagination, of capturing that.
Yeah, you really see the liveliness of nature. Mm-hmm. In, you know, it might not be teeming with a lot of people or wildlife, but you do see sort of the power in mm-hmm. these illustrations.
I think that's hard, too. It's very hard to do for an illustrator, because oftentimes, and I think even as writers, we want to put in, we think the more stuff we put in, the more interesting our work will be. And sometimes less is more. And I think that's what Linda did in this book.
Edited herself.
Edited herself and made it very spare and very beautiful.
Did we say who your illustrator was?
We might not have named her. Her name is Linda Wingerter. And she also illustrated another book of mine, The Water Gift and the Pig of the Pig.
Is that one book or two books?
It's one book. The Water Gift and the Pig of the Pig.
Okay. Let's see. Tell us a little bit about that next project you're working on. So do you have any difficulty switching between fiction and nonfiction? Because now you're thinking about these ducks that you observed at the CSA mm-hmm. farm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these ducks just told me that I had to write about them. I don't know why. Well, I do know they amused me tremendously, and I wanted to write about them. And I think that's often what happens. I get an idea for a story, and it just takes hold of me. And I remember reading Rosemary Wells in one of her essays saying, "We don't choose our stories, they choose us." And I really think in some ways that's true. you just feel impelled. You have to figure out how to tell this story. So I had this idea. I wanted to write about these ducks that seem to all move in the same direction and have the same thoughts. And I thought, what if you lived on a farm with those ducks, but you didn't move that way? You weren't a racer duck. You were slow. And you didn't have their same thoughts. What would that be like?
So it would be sort of like a writer growing up among non-writers, wouldn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Eventually, I worked out something, and the name of the story now, of course, it hasn't been published, and I'm just sending it out right now, but the name of the story is Bim, Bam, Bop, and Una.
And Una is the outside.
And Una is, yeah, Bim, Bam, Bop.
The outlier duck.
Yeah. When I am up in St. Paul at Hamline University for the residency, we often go to a Korean restaurant and we eat a dish called bibimbap. And, you know, with a writer, there's just all of this stuff up there floating around in our heads all the time. And I was trying to think of a series of names that are similar but different. And bibimbap just
And
seemed,
that's a menu item.
It's a menu item. Yeah.
You seem to have a background in poetry. Have you studied poetry? Because you seem to have a real facility for rhythm and language without writing. I don't think any of your books are actually rhymed books, but they feel very poetic and very lyrical.
You know, I loved the sound of words. I've always loved the sounds of words. And actually, when I was in elementary school, we had to memorize a few poems. I remember memorizing The Village Blacksmith, which I don't even think anybody ever reads The Village Blacksmith.
Do you remember any of it?
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. Well, I don't remember much more. In any case, I think that's really good. I actually think if anybody's listening, any children or adults who think they want to write, it's a good idea to memorize poetry. It gets the sounds of words into your head in a very deep place where you don't have to think about it all the time.
Kind of a visceral.
But they're there. Yes.
Visceral.
Kind of visceral. Way. And I don't think it's ever too late to start. In fact, it's something that I actually think I ought to do more of because I haven't done it for a long time.
Do you read poetry?
I do read poetry.
You do read poetry.
Yeah.
And your husband is an English professor.
Yes, he is.
Retired now.
Mm-hmm.
What was his specialty?
American literature.
I kind of visualize you two reading poetry to each other, but is that like...
He reads to me. He's a very good reader.
He does read to you.
He does read to me, yeah.
So you're absorbing that rhythm in the uh-huh. language even yet. Do you still memorize poetry?
I haven't done that for a long time, but just talking about it makes me want to do it. I have a friend, Anne Ilvesacker, who also writes children's books, who memorized The Entire Renaissance by... Edna St. Vincent Millay. It's like a 12-page poem, and she memorized the entire thing. Isn't that
amazing?
Was
that to inform her writing with rhythm, or was
she just wanted to memorize some poetry? And so she would do it. She is a walker, and she would walk for an hour a day, and she would memorize a few more lines every day.
Well, that's fascinating. You often hear the advice when you read essays by writers on writing that you should walk alone. Does she walk alone while she's...
She did.
It'd be hard
yeah.
to carry on a conversation with your walking buddy if you're memorizing,
memorizing.
A 12-page poem in your head.
Yeah.
Do you do a lot of walking?
I have not been walking very much this winter, but I love walking in the summertime. I do. Rich and I, my husband, live quite close to the Palisades, Kepler State Park, and it's our favorite, my favorite place to walk. I shouldn't speak for him, but it's my favorite place to walk.
What are some other things besides memorizing poetry, maybe taking solitary walks, other tips that you would have for people who are interested in writing or expanding their creativity?
Well, reading, of course. Gary Paulsen says anybody who wants to write should read like a wolf eats. Just read everything they can find to read. And read especially the books you love, because those are the kind of books that you are going to want to write, books that you love. And do whatever a person finds that they love doing, gardening or skateboarding or dancing, do that. Have experiences and keep a journal that you don't share, that you don't show to anyone else. And I would say, especially for young people who want to write, just write, but don't feel like you have to share your private writing or you have to send it off to be published. Just kind of work on it. Keep it your project. I don't share my writing until I have a draft that I feel has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and is sort of has a shape. When I first start a piece, it kind of seems like jelly to me. It doesn't always hold its shape, and it comes and goes. One day I'll think it's wonderful, and another day I'll think it's terrible. It's just kind of shapeless. I never show that writing, that shapeless writing. I wait until I have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it seems to have developed some bones somehow, and I don't know how that happens. Just working on it, I think, maybe helps that to happen. But don't feel like you have to share your writing until you are ready, and until you think, okay, I've written this piece, it's sat for a while. You may eventually want to share it. You may never want to share it. Either way is okay, because every piece we write gets us to a new place as a writer. So some pieces are practice pieces, some pieces are not.
I would like to know how many drafts you wrote of the Chiru of High Tibet. You told us already that you had a draft before you went to Tibet. You had already read books by the people who had gone on the expedition you were writing about, and you had done some telephone interviews with them, it sounds like. And when you went home, how much did you change the draft that you had gone to Tibet with?
I didn't change a huge amount. I added some parts, and then, of course, when I added, I had to take out some other parts because a picture book can't be terribly long. This book, I think, always had about the same form that it started with. I cut a lot. It probably has maybe two-thirds of the words that it started out, but it always had that kind of episodic form. Snowflake Bentley, I did many revisions, and I did three separate different drafts of the story to try to figure out the best way to tell the story.
But was that your first nonfiction book?
Yes, it was.
So maybe that is part of learning the parameters of the genre, do you think?
I don't know. There is something about when the facts are given to you as they are in nonfiction, the real challenge for the writer is, what's the best way to present them? What's the most effective way to tell the story? So maybe that is part of writing nonfiction. The first time I did it, I added a lot of made-up parts, a lot of invented parts, and it was way too long.
Oh, Snowflake Bentley?
Snowflake Bentley. And then the second time I did Snowflake Bentley, I had the story told from a niece. He really did have a niece, and I pretended that she was telling the story of his life. And then the third time is the version that was published. So each version of that book was distinct. With the Chiru book, I wouldn't say, I think that the shape of it was always the same, pretty much, but I did move the pieces around and I did cut some to make it sparer as time went on.
That's always good. Concise is always good. Cutting is a very powerful tool. I'm going to let you choose a section to read, and while you're finding your section, I want to do our station identification. This is 100.1 FM. You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm Cheryl Fusco Johnson, guest host of Writers' Voices today, and with me is Jacqueline Briggs Martin, an award-winning picture book writer who lives in Mount Vernon, Iowa, and she's about to read from her latest book.
I think I'll start at the beginning, and as I said, this book is divided into sections. And the first section is called the Chung Tung. The Chung Tung is the wilderness preserve on the northern plain of Tibet. And the Chinese government has actually made this into a preserve so that the animals that live there can be protected. So this is the beginning of the book, the Chung Tung. There is a place so cold, it takes the fleece of five sheep to keep one person warm. So high, with so little rain, the tallest tree is a shrub that would not reach a grown man's knee. This place is called the Chung Tung, the northern plains of Tibet. In this cold, windy country lived the Chiru. Without the Chiru, there would be no story. Chiru. Chiru are the only animals of their kind. They look like antelope, but are related to wild goats and sheep. Chiru males have long black horns that might be taken for a moving forest of tree branches when a group passes by. Many Tibetans believe these horns have special healing powers. The Chiru are also special for this. Each summer, across the Chung Tung, Chiru females migrate in large groups to faraway secret areas to give birth. Where are these secret places? For hundreds of years, even Tibetan nomads did not know. Chiru wool is special too, the warmest and finest in the world. People call it shatush, the king of wools. Shawls made of shatush are elegant, soft, and warm. When wealthy women in the cities of the world discovered these shawls, Chiru across the Chung Tung were killed for their wool. The population shrank from 1 million Chiru to fewer than 100,000. In the wide, unpeopled plains, who would care if the Chiru disappeared? Without George B. Schaller, there would be no story.
It was beautiful, thank you. And I think that it shows how you frame nonfiction, where you introduce it with a little bit of a mystery of where is the birthing place, you know, where is the secret place, and then you let the story unfold about people searching for it. So I really like the way you frame this story. There's another book of yours I also want us to talk a little bit about, and that's The Finest Horse in Town. Would you tell our readers about that picture book?
That book started, it's a family story. My mother was raised by a housekeeper and her dad, but she had an aunt, Aunt Zilpha, who taught her to sew. And Aunt Zilpha was very important to my mother. So when I grew up and my daughter Sarah was about 10 years old, we went back to Maine, where my mother lived and where she grew up, and I grew up too. And we decided we wanted to do some detective work and find out about Aunt Zilpha. Aunt Zilpha and her sister Stella were businesswomen around the 1890s. They had a store in a town called Norway, Maine, and they were seamstresses. They sold fabric and needles and pins and underwear and shoes, and they also sewed dresses for people. We wanted to find the site of that store and find out what we could learn about them. So we went to Norway, Maine, and we found where the store used to be. We went to the library, and we found some old newspaper ads for the store, and the librarian happened to notice us and say, "Oh, what are you doing?" So we told her what we were doing, and she said, "You should go to the jewelry store. There's an old jeweler there who's 92 years old now, and he might remember your relatives." So we went there, and he said, "I do remember them, and I remember that they had the finest horse in town, and that they like to take that horse out for drives on Wednesday afternoon and Sunday afternoon." And that was pretty much all he remembered. I think he remembered they had a candy dish in their store, too. And of course, he was a little boy at the time, and he would remember that. Well, I came back to Iowa, where I live, after our summer vacation, and I wanted to write about these sisters, but I only knew that they had the finest horse in town. So what I ended up doing was writing three little speculations. They all start out with the fact that these sisters had a store and they had the finest horse in town. And then they kind of are three separate answers to, well, what might have happened with these sisters and their horse and their store? And in one, somebody steals the horse. My grandfather was a cattle trader, cattle dealer, and every now and then there would be some sort of notion of, well, where did that cow go to? Well, somebody must have taken her. So I kind of adopted that idea into my book. Another one was just totally made up. Somebody teaches the horse to dance. And the third one, the horse eats choke cherries, and gets really sick. And when I was growing up on the farm in Maine, my dad had some heifers who ate paint, and eating paint is not a good thing for heifers to do. Well, I had that up in my head, I think, And it came out in the story as the horse eating choke cherries. So those were the three made-up events that I kind of grafted on to this real truth about my great aunt's having the finest horse in town. And I think that writers often do things like that. We take something that's really happened and we twist it a little bit, or we add something to it to make a story out of it. Of course, if I had known more about the aunts, I could have just written their story. But sometimes we just don't know, and we still want to do a piece of writing.
And I like how the process of writing is an adventure for you, because when you were researching to find out, you took your mother and your daughter, is that right?
Yes.
So that was probably a real high point in the relationship of all three of you, where you went and pursued your family history together.
It was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it. And an interesting little thing about researching that story that I just remember, I knew that the horse was going to eat choke cherries, but I didn't exactly know what would happen to the horse. Someone gave me the name of a vet here in Fairfield who was a large animal vet. And I wrote to him and said, what would happen to a horse who ate choke cherries? So that's a little Fairfield connection with my research.
That's cool. And you're not shy about contacting people, obviously. For your latest book, The Chiru of High Tibet, you contacted the people who went on this mm-hmm. expedition.
I have found that if I do the initial research and learn all that I can on my own, and I get to a place where I can't learn any more on my own and I have questions, if I contact the people who have answers and I say, I know this much, but I can't figure this out, that they are often very willing to help.
I imagine they appreciate having someone who's so conscientious as you are in not only doing the research, but in the final project, really trying to present something beautiful and informative.
It's a cooperative venture, I think. I think that the people who, say, work to save the Chiru were glad to think that children would learn about the Chiru. So we are actually all walking on the same path.
I'd like writers and just people who are interested in writing family history to know about the resources you've created on a website. Could you tell us a little about that?
I did a project a few years ago. It started, a teacher in Washington, Iowa, asked me to create some curriculum, kind of based on what I did for the finest horse in town, for her students, that they could research their family history. So I did that. And I believe that's on my website, but then I did a book called Jacqueline Briggs Martin and You, which is a book for children who might want to write. It's stories behind my stories, and it involves making up stories, how a person might start with an idea and add to it. It involves taking a nugget of one's family history and writing a story, or just researching an important place in a person's town and writing about that.
And where can people get a copy of this?
They can. That book is called Jacqueline Briggs Martin and You, and I think that you can order it from bookstores. You can also go to my website and print off the curriculum that I did for the school in Washington, Iowa, which might be a good place to start.
And where did you get your facility in creating curriculum?
I have a friend, Sharon McElmeel, who used to be a school librarian in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and she is my proofreader for my curriculum projects.
But you also were a teacher yourself.
I taught preschool, yes.
How many years did you do that?
Oh, gosh, 15 years, I think.
At the time that you were teaching full-time doing preschool, were you also writing?
I was. I would get up at 4:30 in the morning and write for a couple of hours. And then,
how many years did you do that before your first picture book was published?
Oh, I think I probably wrote for 5 or 6 years before I had a contract. Some people had expressed interest in my work, but nothing serious.
Well, you've told us about writing just for developing the craft without feeling like you have to show it to anyone. Is that sort of the idea that sustained you when you were getting maybe rejection slips during those 5 years, that you just knew you wanted to continue to perfect your craft?
You know, when I was starting, at some point in those 5 years, I read an article by a person who wrote and received rejections, and she said, I asked myself one day, what would I do different tomorrow if it had been an acceptance? I would still get up, and I would still write. And I thought, yes, that's true. If it were a rejection, I'm going to get up and write. If it's an acceptance, I'm going to get up and write. So I think there is that sense of, I'm a writer. I'm going to write. That's what I do. It's nice to get acceptances every now and then, but I think as writers, we just keep trying to be better.
Well, that's excellent advice. Tell us a little about your relationship with your, have you had different editors?
When I started out, I had a lot of different editors. And then for Snowflake Bentley, I happened to be paired by the publisher, Anita Silvey at Houghton Mifflin, with an editor, Ann Ryder, who lives up in Lutzen, Minnesota, and works for Houghton Mifflin. We worked on Snowflake Bentley together, and we have worked on all of my books since then. So she's a wonderful editor. I trust her judgment. She believes in quality books for kids is the most important thing. And that's what I believe, too. So,
have you ever met in person?
Yes, we have. I actually drove up to Lutzen, Minnesota last fall to see her.
That was the first time?
No, I met her for the first time in person at the American Library Association meeting the year that Snowflake Bentley was awarded the Caldecott Medal and Mary Azarian gave her speech. It was a wonderful occasion. It was a wonderful
occasion. Do you do much public speaking now?
I do some. I go to schools and I sometimes speak to groups of teachers or groups of librarians. And I also am on the faculty of the Hamline University Low Residency Program in Writing for Children and Young Adults.
Do you spend much time around children?
I have 3 grandchildren, so I see them as often as I can, which is at least once a month for 2 of them. And the one who lives in Brooklyn, not quite once a month, but as often as I can get out to Brooklyn, I see her.
Have you written any projects specifically for your grandchildren?
Sarah, my daughter, and I did a story for the first grandchild, or about the first grandchild, called Banjo Granny. And Owen, the grandchild, lived in California when he was born. And I just had this urge to see him, but I couldn't just jump on a plane and go to California. I couldn't take a train. I couldn't drive. I couldn't see him. So I did what writers do. I imagined myself putting on my 1,000-mile shoes and striking out west for California. And I wrote to Sarah, who was a young mother at the time, and said, Sarah, do you want to help me write this story? And she said, sure. So we wrote about a granny with a banjo case, with some granny magic that I don't quite have, who walks to California. And Sarah actually wrote a song to go with that story.
Was that book published too?
Yes, it was.
How many books have you published in your career?
I've published 17 books, plus the Jacqueline Briggs Martin and You, so 18.
So we don't have much time left. I want to again do our station identification. This is KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio. You've been listening to Jacqueline Briggs Martin, a picture book author from Mount Vernon, Iowa, and we've been discussing the Chiru of High Tibet. Do you have any final word?
Well, I just want to thank you for inviting me to come down here, Cheryl. It's been wonderful to have an hour to talk about writing and talk about books with you. And I hope that there have been some writers and readers who've listened to us who will do more writing and reading as a result.
Well, I could talk to you for 5 hours, but I think that our time is up. Thank you for joining us today.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.